The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're talking about the microscopic organisms that share our planet, and the problems that arise when they wind up in our bodies. We'll talk to science writer Carl Zimmer about his book, A Planet of Viruses. But first, let's learn about the nearly indestructible disease-causing proteins called prions. I'm here with Philip Yam, blogger and managing editor at scientificamerican.com. Philip started at Scientific American magazine in 1989, first as a copy editor and then as a features editor. He's also the author of the book, The Pathological Protein, Mad Cow, Chronic Wasting, and Other Prion Diseases. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Philip.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, those of us that have even heard of prions tend to think of them as being something like a virus or a bacteria, but they're really something altogether different, aren't they?
That's right. They're actually little bits of protein. It's spelled prions, but it's actually pronounced prions, the way the inventor of the term calls it. But yes, these are just tiny little bits of protein that can be infectious. So they're completely different from, say, viruses or bacteria or parasites in that they don't have any genes. They're just protein.
Now, are they alive then?
No, they're not alive. You can think of them as kind of crystals. And what's interesting about them is that we all have them, and they have a normal function in our bodies. The problem is when they become malformed. And when they become malformed, and that's when they can actually cause other normal healthy prion proteins to become as pathological, as deadly. It's sort of like what Kurt Vonnegut imagined in his book, Cat's Cradle. He imagined something called Ice-9, which is a form of water that is liquid but can easily crystallize and turn into ice at room temperature. And in the book, the whole world turns into ice because of a seeding event. So it's like a crystal in the sense that it can, when it touches other of its kind, it turns into that crystal. So there's a physical basis for this. But as it's basically just a protein that has gone bad and therefore can make other proteins go bad, almost like one rotten apple turning the whole bunch bad.
The thing about prions is that they are very, very difficult to get rid of, correct?
That's correct. I mean, they're really, normally if you want to disinfect things, you would boil it. For instance, you boil water for a few minutes, you kill all the viruses, you kill all the bacteria and all the fungi and the parasites. But for prions, they will survive. Well, they will remain infectious. They're basically very hard, stiff proteins. Even standard sterilization won't kill them. And that was one of the most interesting things about it, is that they can cause disease. They cause a brain disease. And what research discovered back in the 70s was that when they had used electrodes to treat epilepsy in some patients, well, one of these patients had a prion disease back then, and they didn't know about it. So they used the electrodes in the brain and then disinfected it with their usual protocols, basically wiping it down and teething. And then 18 months later, they used the electrodes on another epilepsy patient. And what happened was that this patient contracted the brain disease caused by prions. The prions basically remained alive or infectious, even though it had been sterilized by standard protocols. So basically, the standard way of doing things shows that it wouldn't be enough to inactivate prions.
So we're saying, I just want to make this clear for everybody, there's nothing like antibiotics to treat prions.
There's really nothing like that to treat them. The only way to really break them down is with like industrial strength drain cleaner. Basically, other enzymes that break down proteins are needed. And you can't use that. Let's say you're infected with prions. You can't really use that on your body because then your own body's proteins will start breaking down. This is commonly a disease of, first discovered in sheep, actually. It's called a disease called scraping. And occasionally there have been outbreaks in the past. And what the USDA has done, for instance, when they discovered a farm full of potentially infected sheep, would kill the sheep and then boil their carcasses in plumber's lye, which is used to, you know, drain clog remover. And that's the only way they could feel sure that there are no more infectious prions in whatever remains of the carcass.
That's harsh, sir.
That is very harsh. It's a fatal disease if Fortunately, it's very, very rare in humans, especially. There were cases in Britain in the 80s and 90s, a big something called mad cow disease. That created a huge fright in England. Anyone visited them, because in particular, it could be in theory been in any beef they had eaten during the times when it was most infectious, probably in the 70s and 80s. And it would take 10 years to manifest itself. I mean, this is a slow disease that slowly reaches the brain and really causes the brain to become full of holes. It destroys bits of brain matter. And if you look at the autopsy, it actually gives the brain the appearance of a sponge, which is why researchers call it a spongiform encephalopathy, spongy brain tissue. So it was very scary during those times. And there was no, and there still is no treatment for it. There's some experimental attempts tried that seem to extend some life, but by and large, if you're diagnosed with something like this, it is a death sentence.
Well, now, does it only affect mammals?
So far, we've only seen it in mammals, sheep, cows, for instance, also some reports of possibility in pigs. But we also see now, most recently, in deer, elk, some moose. This is happening in the Rocky Mountain areas, also into Alberta and Saskatchewan in Canada. This prion disease in this form is called chronic wasting disease. It was discovered in 1967, and basically in that symptoms of deer and elk look very emaciated, skinny, very weak. It was only more recently that it was discovered that they were suffering from a prion disease. No one is sure exactly how they got it. We know, for instance, when mad cow broke out, the thinking goes that it came from sheep, in particular because to create cattle feed, what they had done in Britain was to grind up carcasses of other animals, and some of these animals are sheep, and they were fed to cows. In the case for chronic wasting disease of deer, it's not clear where it got started, but it is the only disease, it's the only prion disease that's out in the wild, actually. So right now, it's been observed in at least 12 states in the United States and two Canadian provinces. And it seems to have spread because ranchers had moved the and game farms had moved the animals around. Some of the animals have escaped and are running wild.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Philip Yam. As managing editor, he's responsible for the news content of scientificamerican.com. He's also the author of The Pathological Protein, Mad Cow, Chronic Wasting, and Other Prion Diseases. So how do prions spread in people? Can they spread from person to person or just through things like tainted meat?
They can spread through person to person, but usually it's only through medical procedures. But we also have in history, it has been spread through cannibalism. Back in the 1920s and 30s, there was a tribe in Papua New Guinea that practiced cannibalism. They observed that when they buried a body, the area would become more fertile, things would grow more. So they thought that consuming a dead body would give them some sort of restorative life-generating powers. So it became a kind of a funerary practice where people in the village would gather and eat the remains of their loved ones. It turns out that maybe some of these people had a prion disease, and by eating them, they contracted the disease themselves. That disease died out once cannibalism was banned in that area around 1940, 1950. Most other transmissions have been medical. For instance, some people with the disease had donated their corneas, and these corneas were then given to other people. So during these transplants, the prions in the cornea migrated to the brain and caused the brain to die off.
Interesting.
Even donations of this layer of the brain called the dura mater, and that also is used as a patch in some neurosurgery, and in some cases people contracted the disease because surgeons use this patch on their brains.
So now this is awful, obviously. So
it's a very bad disease. It's basically, especially in the UK, when people are suffering from who has contracted the human form of mad cow disease, typically struck very young people, like 18, 19, people in the prime of their life, heading off to be productive, and then they were struck down, which basically was like dementia for a lot of their families. And just they couldn't understand what was going on. All the signs of senility, of Alzheimer's in like a 19-year-old. And it took a while before they figured out what was going wrong.
Well, it turns out that nature might actually have a response to prion proteins. You wrote a blog post in May called Natural Born Prion Killers, Lichens Degrade Mad Cow-Related Brain Pathogen. Maybe tell us a bit about the research that you were writing about.
Yeah, that research was really interesting because it's the first instance where there's a chemical that exists naturally, and it turned out to be from common lichen. It kind of looks like moss, but it's not really. It's actually an agglomeration of algae, bacteria, and fungus all together as a collective. And they produce an enzyme that seems to break down the prions. This was only a laboratory study. They extract some of the enzymes from the lichen and mix it in a test tube and put some prions in it to see what happened. But what was interesting to me is that this exists naturally. Scientists can create, derive other kinds of enzymes that break down prions, but this is one that exists out in nature and is out there now. To me, I found it particularly interesting because I've always been concerned that among deer and wild animals, having a prion disease means that they can spread it. And when they encounter another species, all hell kind of breaks loose.
Right.
You don't know how it's going to be transformed in that species. And we saw that with mad cow disease. Because these prions can survive a long time in the wild, for instance, it's probably excreted by animals in their urine, saliva, and feces. They can survive in the soil for quite some time. There was really no mechanism to break them down at all, actually, until I read about the lichens and their enzymes. So here you have a natural break to the spread that could exist. Whether it's practical, it's not really clear, but I thought it was good news because that suggests that nature may have other enzymes out there that exist that can prevent prions and maybe keep it from spreading.
So that research was done in a lab setting then, but they think it might be able to happen in the environment as well?
Yeah, I don't see why it wouldn't happen because it was just naturally derived straight from the lichen. So if, for instance, an animal urinated on the lichen could, in principle, break down any prions in that urine. It's not clear, of course, whether that's the case, but, you know, to me, what's exciting is that it actually exists. So it leaves a lot of hope that there are plenty of other lots of natural enzymes out there that can break down this bad, deadly protein.
So is there any indication that that kind of enzyme could be used to treat an infected person?
No indication yet. My guess it's probably not possible just because the enzyme probably would also damage the healthy proteins in your body. It might be possible to use as a partial treatment if you know the point of infection, but usually you don't know a person is infected until they have brain symptoms, which means that their prion has already reached the brain. There is no real good blood test, for instance, to determine whether you're infected with the prions, and this is what was really scary back in the 80s and 90s. You know, 60 million people in the UK who largely had eaten meat, beef, there's no way to tell that they were infected. And in fact, the US bans anyone from any blood donations from those in England. And even in England, people born after 1996 do not get blood transfusions from British people. They get it from another country that was considered mad cow free because they're afraid that there's some prions in the blood. And in fact, there are at least two cases in which people got the disease through blood transfusions. So for treating people, it's probably, you would have to catch it early, but it's almost impossible to tell at this point whether someone's infected, because by the time we know, it's already in the brain, and it's very difficult to treat infections of the brain. But the good news is that it's a very rare disease. Fewer than 200 people have died from the mad cow form, the human form of mad cow disease. So it's not likely that, and especially now as time has passed, it becomes clear that while a lot of people may have been exposed to prions in Britain, so few actually came down with it, meaning that the infection really didn't take. So I think we're really lucky there because it would have gone either way. But that's good news now, looking back through the lens of time. It's a disease that's very hard to get.
I like that you left that on a positive note, sir.
I like to be positive about this. But, you know, there's been a lot of research on it, and they're tracking all the medical transmissions, and even then scientists know now and understand why it happened, so they're better prepared to prevent it from happening anymore. So that's why, fortunately, you don't hear too much about prion diseases as a kind of a medical scourge. You hear most of it as it relates to animal diseases, such as that we see in deer.
Well, I do live in Alberta, and so we've definitely had our experience with this. So I'm content to leave that on an optimistic note.
Good going.
Philip, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks a lot. Had fun here.
You can find links to Philip Yam in his book, The Pathological Protein, Mad Cow, Chronic Wasting, and Other Prion Disease, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Carl Zimmer, author of A Planet of Viruses, right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm here with Carl Zimmer, Yale lecturer and award-winning science writer. He's written hundreds of articles for the New York Times and magazines like National Geographic, Time, Scientific American, and Popular Science. From 1994 to 98, he was a senior editor at Discover, where he's still a contributing editor, and where he also writes a monthly column about the brain. The latest of his 10 books is A Planet of Viruses. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Carl.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now let's start out easy. What is a virus precisely?
So basically, a virus is a very, very small shell of protein with some genes inside. There are some variations on it, but that's basically what viruses are. And so that's important in a lot of ways for telling you what viruses are not. So they're not like our cells, and they're not like bacteria, for example. They don't have anything inside of them for actually building new proteins or growing or dividing. They're basically little delivery systems that inject genes into host cells, and that's how viruses make new copies of themselves.
Well, when did science first realize that there were viruses at all?
Well, you know, obviously, I mean, people were well aware of the symptoms of viruses for, you know, millions of years. I mean, we've been infected with viruses as long as we've been around and before we were human. But there was sort of a gradual emerging sense that these diseases, like the flu or smallpox, were caused by some kind of agent. So, for example, in the late 1700s, Edward Jenner created a vaccine for smallpox. Basically, he realized that if you took some material from the sores of people with cowpox, a related virus, and inoculated people with it in their skin, it somehow protected them from getting sick from smallpox. He didn't really know what viruses look like or what they were made of or any of that, but he had this kind of basic sense that viruses were something that transmitted disease from person to person. So, you know, you didn't get smallpox just by walking past a swamp where some miasma was coming up. Still, though, it wasn't for another century until people really started to realize in a more precise way what viruses are. So the first viruses that were really well established actually are viruses of plants. So, you know, animals get viruses and plants get viruses and mushrooms get viruses and bacteria get viruses. Everything gets viruses. But in this case, it was the tobacco plant, and there was this virus that was getting these tobacco plants sick. They were wilting. And so some scientists, what they did was they would take these sick leaves and they'd grind them up, mush them up, and then pass them through filters. And eventually they would pass them through filters that were basically made of porcelain. And so just about nothing could get through it. Like, no bacteria could get through it. And they would end up with this clear liquid. And yet they could take that liquid and they could stick it in another tobacco plant, and that tobacco plant would wilt. So then they said, okay, whatever's in there, that's a virus. It's really small, and causes disease.
We already have an email question from Elizabeth.
I've read differing arguments about whether or not viruses are actually alive. Aren't they basically just little packets of DNA? Doesn't sound like life to me. What's your position?
It's a great question, but I find that phrase that she used at the end there very telling. It doesn't sound like life to me. We wouldn't say, you know, that doesn't sound like the number four to me. You know, two plus two doesn't sound like the number four. We'd know it's four or not four. We'd have some exact kind of way of dealing with that.
Right.
When it comes to life, there's no definition of life. There's no generally accepted definition of life at all. There was a scientist I spoke to a few years back. He had just written a book about this very subject, definitions of life, concepts of life. And he said that he was collecting these different definitions. Some people say, well, it has to be a system that can experience Darwinian evolution. Or some people say, well, it has to be something that can do metabolism. And basically, I said to him, well, how many of these definitions did you collect? And he said, I stopped counting at around 300. So the thing is that we don't really have a good, solid definition of what life is. And so for people to say, well, you know, are viruses alive or not, it's a really hard question to answer, since we don't agree on the ground rules. Now, I would say that they've got a whole lot of what we associate with being alive, actually more than a lot of people I think realize. So they do evolve. They are, you know, incredibly, you know, well adapted to different kinds of ecological roles. They can evade our immune systems. They can go from one host to another. They can do all sorts of things. And so, okay, it's true, they can't build a protein, but I don't know. It seems to me that if they're not alive, they're pretty close.
What do they do exactly, specifically to the cells that they infect?
It really depends on the kind of virus you're talking about. I mean, for the fine details, but let's just take like the flu. You know, so let's say that, you know, you're standing next to someone and that person sneezes and all these little droplets are floating in the air, and you pick one of them up and it ends up in your mouth and it's got a bunch of viruses in it. So those are going to travel down into your airway, and you know, there'll be a virus that will come out of the droplet and invade one of the cells that lines your airway. So what it's going to do is it's going to latch on, because it's got these sort of protein knobs on the outside of it, of the shell, that can basically slip into the cell through certain receptors that are on your cell. So your cell actually ends up drawing in the virus. It opens up, releases its genes and these proteins as well. And then what happens next is that these genes start getting copied by your cell, because the virus starts taking over. Your cell isn't really able to do anything else except make copies of this virus gene, or genes, I should say. They have about 10 genes. They also make new proteins that actually fit them together to build a shell for these new viruses. And so one virus goes in, and then lots of viruses burst out, and the cell dies as they come out. And then they just go off to look for a new cell to infect.
The effects of viruses vary spectacularly, really, from with the flu, a simple fever maybe, to something like bleeding from your eyes. But they've also been at the root of some really interesting urban legends. So do tell us about the jackalope, sir.
Sure. So people who travel in the American West may sometimes, you know, walk into a diner and look up at the wall, and they'll see the head of a rabbit with antelope horns sticking out of it. And, you know, the more gullible of them might be persuaded that it's something called a jackalope. And so there's this sort of kind of tongue-in-cheek, you know, legend of the jackalope. You can buy jackalope postcards and so on. And the idea is that there are these rabbits with horns. And the odd thing is that there actually are some rabbits with horns, but the thing is that they're not growing antlers like an antelope. What happens is that they get infected with a virus. It's papillomavirus. This particular kind of papillomavirus will infect the skin of rabbits. And, you know, a lot of the time, actually, it doesn't cause any trouble at all. It's incredibly mild. But then sometimes it will cause its host cell to reproduce too quickly, and so that you start getting these growths that are coming from infected cells. And so there will sometimes be these rabbits walking around with these strange growths on their head, and they might look like horns to someone. So that's where the myth of the jackalope has actually came from. And it was actually rabbits infected with papillomavirus that first led to the discovery of papillomavirus, period. You know, someone had heard this story, a researcher at Rockefeller University, and asked a friend who hunted out west to send him some of these rabbits, and he ground up the tissue and found that he could infect other rabbits with it. And this papillomavirus, you know, in some cases it just causes these antlers. In other cases, it can cause warts. And in still other cases, it can actually cause cervical cancer. This is the same papillomavirus there's been so much controversy over recently, because right. We now have a vaccine that can stop some of the cancer-causing strains of the virus. And the discovery of this was actually done with these, you know, so-called jackalopes.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest today is Carl Zimmer, science journalist and author of A Planet of Viruses. So how many viruses are there, approximately?
A lot.
Right.
The number I have seen is 10 to the power of 31. So that's a 1 with 31 zeros after it. And that's a lot of viruses. That's more viruses on Earth than there are stars in the universe. They are by far the most abundant life form on Earth. If you accept that viruses are alive, or at least a life form,
right.
They're far more abundant than anything else combined.
Well, in your book, you referenced a 2009 study that showed that on average, people hold 174 species of viruses in their lungs, and only 10% were viruses that we already knew about at the time of this study. All the others were new. So does that mean that the study of viruses is still a fairly new field, or that we're seeing a constant evolution of new viruses?
No. These are just viruses that have been hanging around, essentially waiting for someone to discover them. It is true that even within our own bodies, we have this completely unexplored frontier of virology. The problem had been for a long time that you know, the only way that scientists knew how to identify new species was, well, you know, if it's an animal, you go and you shoot it and you take it back to, you know, a museum and you analyze it and describe every little feather or horn on it. If it's microscopic, well, then that's a little trickier. And so what you might, if it's bacteria or viruses, you know, you would try to basically raise it in the lab. And this worked pretty well for things that didn't mind living in a lab, you know, where there's lots of oxygen and so on. But if you were fussier, you know, if you were something that died in the presence of oxygen, or if you were a virus that only lived in a certain kind of cell, you might be very fussy. And so scientists just wouldn't know you were there. So the real revolution in discovering new species in our lifetime happened about 10 years ago. It really started to kick in. And basically what happens now is that instead of just trying to grab the organism itself, you just try to grab some DNA. So you can, for example, go to the ocean and scoop up some water, and you can apply some chemicals, and that will break apart proteins and cells, And then you put in some other chemicals that will latch on to genes inside. And it'll essentially pull out fragments of their genomes and then sequence them and then try to piece them together to figure out what you're dealing with. And as soon as you start looking for new species just based on genes, a whole world opens up. And for viruses in particular, it's been astonishing. So again and again and again, wherever you go, inside the human body, in the soil, in the ocean, wherever you go, you will find viruses, and the vast majority of the species of viruses you find, no one has ever seen before. They're only distantly related to anything that's been described previously.
Well, you mentioned genes. In the book, you spoke about the fact that our own genome has a lot of genes from viruses. So how much of our DNA is actually viral?
That's still a kind of an open question. There's definitely parts of the genome, the human genome, there's no question that they're from viruses. I mean, they've got genes that if you just looked at them on their own and you're an expert at identifying DNA, you would say, well, that's a virus, clear cut. And about 8% of our genome is made up of elements from viruses that are like that. That's actually a lot. The genes that encode our own proteins, like in our hair and our skin and our hemoglobin and our blood and those sorts of things, that takes up about 1.1% of our genome. So we're maybe six times more virus than human proteins, as it were. And there might be other parts of the human genome that came from viruses as well, but they've just mutated so much and they're so different now that it's just hard to recognize them as definitely being virus. But there's no question that we have a huge amount of viral DNA we're carrying around.
How did it get there?
We got infected. There are a lot of viruses where the way they replicate is they actually insert their genes into our own genome. So they just plug it in there. So HIV, for example, is a virus that makes a living that way. Other viruses may just sort of, the genes may just be floating around and they get copied just on their own. But there are some viruses that can actually end up in our genome. Now, if you get infected with a virus and, it infects your white blood cells like HIV does, that's as far as it's going to go. Their virus DNA will only be inserted into the genomes of your own cells. But what if a virus like that infects an egg,
right,
for example, and then it inserts its genes into the egg's DNA, and then that egg is fertilized, and then it develops into an embryo, and all those cells in that embryo, they're going to be carrying that viral DNA as well. And so when that embryo develops and becomes an adult, every single cell is going to have that virus in it. So this doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen sometimes. And then, in some cases, an animal can get very sick because of this. In other cases, it's not harmful. And the virus then gets passed down to the next generation. And every time, that animals reproduce, there are mutations. And so the viral DNA that they're carrying mutates, and eventually the virus can no longer break out. It's basically trapped in the host genome, and it just gets carried along through the generations. They're kind of like fossils. You can find the same viruses in the same parts of our genome as you can in, say, chimpanzees and baboons. And so when you see these other species that have the same virus in the same position in their genome, you know that we all inherited it from a common ancestor. So if all old world monkeys and apes and humans have the same viruses, and there are a number of them that they do share, we know that they're 30 million years old.
Right.
In fact, a lot of these viruses seem to have come in around 30 million years ago for whatever reason. But there are viruses that in the human genome, they've dated back 100 million years that we share with all primates and some other mammals. So, over millions of years, every now and then, we have added another piece of viral DNA to the genome. And now here we are with 100,000 viruses that we're carrying around.
Now, I'm thinking, are there any particularly beneficial mutations? If you can
Definitely.
Track the viral DNA within our cells, can you track if they're beneficial or not?
As soon as you find them, you can start asking what's happening with them. So a lot of these mutations, as I said, they just disable the viral DNA. So they will never be able to make any protein or any RNA, which is a single-stranded version of DNA. They're just inert. They're just along for the ride. But there have been genes that scientists have discovered that are clearly virus genes in the human genome that do make proteins. And so then the next question is, well, what do they do? And, you know, the frustrating thing is that in a lot of cases, we don't know what they do. So for example, there have been a number of these virus genes that have been discovered to be active and making proteins in our brains. So, you know, what are you making in our brains? I mean, what do we, you know, how do our brains depend on viruses? Nobody knows yet. But there is one case where it's definitely quite clear what the virus gene is doing. And it's a gene for a protein that is very important in developing the placenta. So when a human embryo or any placental mammal embryo develops, a placenta grows that will attach to the uterus and basically pull in lots of nutrients from the mother. And there's a protein that essentially creates sort of passageways in the layer of cells where the placenta and the uterus make contact. And so that you have this kind of open space where nutrients come in and then can get sucked into the placenta and feed the baby. If you don't have that protein, you know, if they've done experiments where they will shut the gene down in mice and then see what happens, it's impossible for a fetus to develop. It's totally lethal to be without that gene. And that gene definitely came from a virus maybe 100 million years ago.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and science journalist Carl Zimmer is here to talk about viruses. And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the mind-bending physics that happens on the smallest imaginable scales. We're joined by physics professor James Kakalios to talk about his book, The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, a math-free exploration of the science that made our world. And we'll speak to physicist and philosopher Victor Stenger about the ways that quantum physics buzzwords are misused to support some not-so-scientific claims. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I have Carl Zimmer, author, Yale lecturer, and award-winning science writer on the line. We're talking about his latest book, A Planet of Viruses. Now, why are some viruses so much harder for us to deal with than others? For example, like the common cold versus Ebola. Ebola is very scary. I'm a bit fixated on Ebola myself.
Yeah, Ebola is pretty bad. Yeah. I mean, if you get infected with it, chances are that you will start bleeding within a matter of hours, and you might bleed out of your eyeballs, just massive hemorrhaging, and your chances of dying are extremely high. And you know, the main way that it gets from one person to another is, you know, the people who are caring for the sick and who are burying the sick. You know, they can't help but get all this blood on them, and then it's just very contagious that way. It gets into more people and makes them sick as well. And then, yeah, as you say, you have colds where, you know, maybe you're just kind of a bit low for a day or two. And there are even, you know, infections you'll get where, you know, you just go to work anyway or go to school and, you know, you don't feel 100%, but you're fine. And
you're not bleeding out your eyes, sir,
You're not bleeding out of your eyes. Yeah, obviously, you know, I think you'd definitely get a sick day if you called in and said, I'm bleeding from my eyes. Yeah. So why the difference? Well, the thing is that, you know, viruses are diverse, just as other kinds of life forms are diverse. And I'm just going to have to call them life forms because I think I'm just biased. I don't know what else to call them. Because again, there's this similarity between viruses and, say, between plants. So, you know, you could say, well, you know, why are there dandelions when there are redwoods? why should there be one kind of plant when there's another kind of plant? And the fact is that, you know, the dandelion, it's small, it grows fast, it makes lots of seeds, it spreads, it doesn't live very long. The redwood, on the other hand, it grows for thousands of years, and it only needs one tree in a matter of centuries for it to grow its population. It's just a totally different kind of way of living, but both work because they're taking advantage of different niches in the ecosystem. So Ebola, it's very effective in spreading. The problem is it's too effective. It's too deadly. And so what happens is that, it makes lots and lots of copies inside each host, and it can, if it can get to the next host, it'll definitely infect them. But the hosts are dying off so fast that it gets less and less likely after a while for them to be able to really spread out very far. So if you look at the rate of infection for Ebola in humans, every year, maybe a few hundred people get sick and die of it. And I mean, I don't mean to diminish their suffering, but that's a lot less than, the number of people who get the cold. Mm-hmm. I mean, millions upon millions upon millions of people get the cold every year. So there are a lot more cold viruses out there than Ebola viruses. But, both solutions work. Both solutions have allowed these different viruses to keep their populations going and going and going. So there's just a lot of different ways of being a virus out there. The fact is that actually there are some viruses that infect their hosts and not only do they not cause any harmful symptoms, but they're actually helpful. So there are, for example, some fungi that if they get infected with a virus, it actually helps them and the plants that they infect withstand heat. So they actually bring something to the table. They essentially just sort of live inside the cells. They don't, cause all sorts of harm like Ebola would.
I read a story probably about a month or two ago about bacteria being used to stop mosquitoes getting infected with dengue fever in Australia, I think it was. So is the use of one microbe to stop another something that we're actually going to see more of in the future? Is that how we're going to go about treating a lot of this?
It could be. It's possible. So viruses, they infect animals, they infect plants, and they infect bacteria, among other things, including the bacteria that make us sick. Bacteria like E. coli, for example, or Salmonella, or Staph, or Strep. There are viruses that will infect those bacteria, and some of them will just wipe the bacteria out. And so, there's been this idea that's floated around for just about a century that maybe you could use viruses to kill bacteria. The whole discovery that viruses infect bacteria was made by a doctor named Felix Durrell. He was treating soldiers in World War I in France who were sick with dysentery. And so he isolated the bacteria that were making them sick, and then he filtered the fluid that he found the bacteria in, and he filtered and filtered it until he filtered out the bacteria. And then he was left with this substance that he could use to actually then kill the bacteria. And what was in it were these viruses, which we call bacteriophages, meaning they eat bacteria. And so Durrell said, hey, wait a minute. I mean, these things are killing bacteria. If I could concentrate these, then I could create a treatment for this. And he actually did develop some treatments. And in France, this was very big business before the advent of antibiotics. And then when antibiotics showed up, people felt they were more reliable, more effective, and so on. And so people in the West switched very much to antibiotics. But Durrell had been traveling around and sort of, preaching the gospel, as it were, of bacteriophage. And in the Soviet Union, they really took to it, and they actually carried on the research for decades. So in World War II, Stalin's soldiers at the front, when they would get wounded, they would be treated with bandages that were basically drenched with bacteriophages.
Yay.
well, and so now, now we're dealing with antibiotic resistance.
Right.
And now antibiotics are just not doing very well anymore. And so there's a renewed interest in this long, long line of research. Now, it's by no means a guaranteed thing. I've talked to some virologists who are really skeptical because they say, you know, we don't really know what would be effective against a particular kind of bacteria. We may not be able to sort of reproduce it reliably. It may take years before this dream of bacteriophage therapy actually really comes to pass.
Well, now, our strategy for dealing with viruses is vaccine-based. So why do we treat them that way instead of with drugs like we do bacterial infections?
Well, vaccines are a great thing if you can get them to work, if you can invent one that works, and then if you can set up a program to get lots of people vaccinated. Because, you know, you give people a shot, and for a really long period of time, nobody's going to get sick. And so rather than just waiting for people to get sick and then going out and trying to treat them with antivirals, you stop it before it even starts. Now, unfortunately, that doesn't always work. So, for example, with the flu, you know, vaccines are effective, but they change you have to change them every year because the virus is changing every year. There are lots of viruses that we don't have a vaccine for yet, like dengue fever, for example, no vaccine. Ebola, no vaccine, can't help. Sorry. There are going to be viruses that are going to pop out that we've never seen before, that don't have a name yet. I mean, that's what happened with SARS. I mean, it was this virus living in a bat, and then it made its way into humans in China, and then boom, it was in Toronto, it was in a bunch of other countries. It sounds like the plot from Contagion, but it really happened. And so when new things come out and hit us, you know, we don't have a vaccine for it yet. It'll take months to develop one. So it would be great to have a penicillin for viruses, but that just doesn't exist yet. We may just not know enough about virus biology yet to do that, although there are some people who are definitely trying to find a way to develop something like that.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest today is Carl Zimmer, science journalist and author of A Planet of Viruses. I would ask you for more questions, audience, but we have enough from you, so we'll get right to those. Here's one from the chat from Marie Claire.
Why do you think viruses can be difficult for people to understand, like mistakenly wanting antibiotics or misunderstanding transmission risks?
That's a good question. I've wondered about this, too, because there's a lot of pseudoscience that kind of swirls around viruses in one way or another. You know, we've seen people who refuse to vaccinate their children because they think that the vaccines are going to cause all sorts of horrible problems, and somehow think that viruses, you know, causing measles and other diseases aren't something to be worried about. We've seen conspiracy theories about HIV, that AIDS is not caused by a virus, that HIV doesn't exist, or that HIV was created in a CIA laboratory. I mean, you can find these conspiracy theories all over the place. And I think they're just sort of the perfect thing for the human mind to get confused about, you know, because they're just something that we just did not evolve to understand. They're completely invisible to the naked eye. There's no way that we can really, like, give them kind of an agency the way we could even to a dog. They're just these packages of genes that are just floating around and yet are able to take over a human being. I mean, it's crazy that this incredibly small thing can get inside of us and take over our bodies. And yet there it is. So, I do think, you know, there is a lot of confusion about viruses and bacteria. People do want antibiotics for their viruses, and, you know, doctors prescribe them just in case maybe they do have a bacterial infection, or just because they want to keep their business. And it's a terrible thing because that breeds antibiotic resistance. If you have a cold, penicillin will do you no good.
We have a question from David.
Was H1N1 an epidemic or not? It seems like there was a lot of hype and not a lot of actual illness.
the problem is that when this strain came out in 2009, it was a new strain. I mean, there's no denying that this was a strain of flu that we had not seen before. And we've had some bad experiences with new strains of flu we have not seen before. So in the 50s, in the 70s, there had been what are called pandemics, where many people had died, many people sort of above the normal seasonal flu deaths. And then, of course, in 1918, there was, the great pandemic, the Spanish flu, which may have killed 50 million people. So people sort of in hindsight have said, oh, there was a lot of hype. Maybe, people were, talking about it a lot. But, what were we supposed to do? Ignore it? And
what's the alternative if you do?
What was scary to me was that we were with a flu that turned out to be a flu strain that turned out to be relatively mild. Now that means that if I recall correctly, like 12,000 people died in the United States alone. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's what we're talking about. We're still talking about something that can kill a lot of people, and it did kill a lot of people, but it could have been a lot worse. So here we had something new, and the sort of the public health system didn't do a fantastic job. I mean, I remember wanting to get a vaccine for this, and I couldn't. I couldn't for quite a while because they were raising these vaccines in chicken eggs. This is a technology that was invented in the 1950s, and we're still stuck with it. You know, we live in this age where I was just telling you how we can fish DNA out of the dirt, and yet we can't make a virus vaccine based on these modern technologies. Or at least, we can't. Scientists can in the lab, but there's this huge disconnect to actually making it happen on a wide scale. So that, for me, that was scary alone. Because what happens next time when it is worse and we are still stuck with these stupid eggs?
It's almost a T-shirt right there.
Yeah, it is. It is. Absolutely.
We have a question from Kylie from the chat.
Is it true that antibacterial hand sanitizer does more harm than good when it comes to viruses?
Okay, so there are hand sanitizers that have antibiotics in them, triclosan, and then it's in like soaps and stuff like that, and that's bad. I should say, be clear here. There are scientists who are very concerned about antibiotic resistance, who have warned that this triclosan in all this stuff is going to lead to antibacterial resistance. Antibiotic resistance in bacteria. With viruses, that's not really an issue. But hand sanitizers that have alcohol in them, that's fine. If you just wash your hands with soap and water, that's a really that's a good way to help to avoid getting infected with viruses, and just keep your hands away from your mouth. That's actually a big deal. We involuntarily have our hands and all over our faces all the time. If it's flu season and a bunch of people are sick, people sick in your house, keep your hands away from your mouth, and you'll really boost your chances of getting out of the flu season without getting really sick.
And a question from NT.
MIT has said they've created a drug that can stop a whole range of viral infections by targeting the infected cells rather than the virus itself. What do you think?
He is referring to a study that was published in a journal called PLOS ONE over the summer. It's a very intriguing study. I mean, I've talked to other scientists about it. They think it's an interesting concept, but that it's not ready for prime time, is the way one of them put it. There are just a huge number of hurdles that you have to jump in order to get an antiviral, to patients. We do have some antivirals. So people with HIV is no longer an absolute death sentence, because we have a whole bunch of antivirals people can take that can extend their life. But as I had mentioned, there's no sort of broad-spectrum antiviral, and maybe this MIT stuff could. But it took a long time for those HIV antivirals to get to market, and there were a lot that failed. So think research, when research looks really good in a mouse, so if, you know, the furthest these MIT scientists have gone is infecting mice with the flu, and it seems to work in curing them the flu, which is great. Everything else they did, they were doing it in cells in a dish. And so it's a long way from that to, you know, your doctor saying, writing out a prescription for this for you.
So we can be somewhat excited-ish, perhaps? Excited-esque.
You know, we can talk about it in 5 years.
All right.
Honestly, I mean, in 5 years, we might know if it works or not.
We have the last question, actually, from Brent.
What is the most deadly virus ever discovered?
The most deadly virus ever discovered. Well, I guess it depends on the species. I mean, Ebola is probably up there. You know, it belongs to this group of viruses where the mortality is just so high it's not looking good if you get sick. But there are, there are other viruses that infect, like insects, for example, that make Ebola look like a walk in the park.
You're not going to tell me about those.
Why not? That's what you're going for,
okay,
right?
Okay, bring it.
Okay.
Gentlemen, ask a question.
There's one called baculovirus, which is sort of sprinkled on leaves, and caterpillars come along and they're munching up the leaves. They're basically these sort of leaf vacuums, and they'll swallow these viruses. And, a whole lot of the time they get sick from these viruses. The viruses start breeding like crazy inside of them. And their bodies actually start to swell with viruses. They get fat with viruses. That's how much of a viral load they have. And then they get this bizarre urge to climb up very high. That's why infection with baculovirus is called treetop disease. They go up to the tops of trees, and then they basically, the virus releases an enzyme and they dissolve. And it's like a rain of viruses that comes down and lands on leaves again, and then more caterpillars munch it and face the same fate. So, I wouldn't want Ebola, but if it was a choice between Ebola and being in a caterpillar getting baculovirus, I might go for the Ebola. I don't know. It just, baculovirus seems like really horrific.
Seriously, nature is gross. Honestly.
It is. But, you know, the irony is that baculoviruses are actually incredibly important to biotechnology because the way they grow in the caterpillars is actually they create these big protein balls that are packed with viruses. And you can engineer the viruses, stick in a different gene, and it'll make a protein ball out of whatever protein you want. You want a ball of insulin? You got it. You want whatever protein you're looking for, they'll make it for you. So viruses are you know, the great engineers of the world.
I will accept that. Carl, you are brilliant. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
You can find links to Carl Zimmer and his newest book, A Planet of Viruses, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, do click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, or to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells, cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks, all the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who, I don't think you understand, it's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless, let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore, just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers.
Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.